Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Absolutely everybody has a favorite planet. For highly pragmatic people, their favorite planet might be Earth. But as a child, Saturn was definitely my favorite. The idea that one of our planets just happened to have giant, prominent rings around it just drove the imagination. If that one planet has rings, what kind of other things are planets allowed to have? Maybe planets outside our solar system have other cool accessories we never even dreamed of. So, as a child, Saturn was definitely my favorite. And after a little Google research, it looks like it still wins most internet polls of people's favorite planets. It's really hard to beat those rings. Mars is often a strong contender too, probably because we humans have hopes of traveling there someday. Nowadays though, my favorite is Jupiter. My nerdy reason is that the surface of Jupiter is just an incredible display of two-dimensional fluid dynamics, and you don't get many examples of that in nature. That big red dot on Jupiter's surface is a giant vortex, basically a gigantic hurricane that in principle should dissipate eventually, but has managed to live for centuries just because it's so tremendously large. Okay, we love planets. We love the big ones, we love the little ones, and we especially love the really little ones that don't even technically count as planets, because who doesn't love an underdog? So, since we love planets so much, why haven't I had a planet expert on my show? That's a great question, and I hope to rectify it today. Today's guest is Dr. Jason Wong, professor of physics and astronomy at Northwestern University. Jason primarily studies planets outside our solar system. We call those exoplanets. Jason has helped to develop incredible technology that allows us to directly take images of exoplanets orbiting distant stars many light years away from us. That requires both incredibly powerful telescopes and very sophisticated data analysis techniques for pulling these faint images out of the background noise. We'll be talking to Jason about how he performs these difficult observations and what we can learn from them. And of course, I can't help myself, I will ask him what his favorite planet is. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. He'll probably just do that anyway.
Well, if I get excited, I will definitely increase the volume by a few fold.
I can't wait to hear that in my headphones.
Are you going for ASMR podcast or are you going for excitement?
All right. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Jason Wong, professor of physics and astronomy at Northwestern University. Dr. Wong, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Glad to be on.
All right. So I'd like to get started by asking, you know, how you grew up, how you got to be a scientist, and that sort of thing. So let's start with, where did you grow up?
Yeah. I mostly grew up in Columbus, Ohio. I moved around quite a bit when I was like in my early years, but I started kindergarten in Columbus, and okay. I thankfully tell people I grew up there, because then there's, you know, there's a lot more travel happening. I got a lot of airline miles before the age of five.
I see. Yeah. Is there a reason for that?
Well, it was just my dad came here to the U.S. to do his PhD, and I was actually born in China, and I came here with him.
Okay.
But then my parents decided that taking care of me was too complicated, and doing a PhD and trying to survive in the U.S.
Okay.
So they shipped me back to China to live with my grandparents for a few years, and then so I did a little bit of back and forth when I was very early.
Wow. So then when you started kindergarten. You were that's when you were solidly in the U.S.
They were like, you know, if you want to start a school system, you know, we should pick one and just stick with it. So yes. It's like, clearly, you know, yes, we're staying in the U.S. So, you yes. know, you should stay in the U.S. and start kindergarten.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I actually spent so much time in China that by the time I started kindergarten, I actually had to go to ESL. I actually only knew Chinese at that point and knew very little English. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That must have been scary.
It was okay. I had a few friends at least that also knew Chinese, so they would like translate to me in class while also, you know, when you're a kid, you learn languages super fast, so, you know, after 1 year I was fluent in English. I don't even remember the process of learning English. It just came naturally. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I didn't even realize that I would have had that in my head, that you would have even had any period where you didn't
as a kid.
I mean, I have, you know, a very standard Midwestern, you know, Central Ohio accent. You can't really tell.
Right.
And actually, another advantage is because I actually learned Chinese first, I'm also fluent in Chinese and don't really have an accent there. So people on either side don't realize.
I assume that you were born.
Yeah.
And you kind of were.
Yeah. I was born in one country and I grew up in the other. So, you know, depending on how I phrase it, it's technically correct.
Right. Good.
Yes.
Cool. So then, can you think of a memory of like the first time you were interested in science?
Yeah. I probably was not interested in science until like the end of high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. To be honest, like I was always good at math. And like, I had a pretty strong math preparation. So I would do, I was intrinsically good at some of the quantitative aspects of science, but like I never did like science fairs or any of those things. And I was like being a scientist wasn't really a top thing for me. I actually had no idea what I wanted to do. In high school, my friends who were, the more overachieving type were like, I'm doubling up on science every year. It's like, take all the science classes and get all the AP credits and things like that. Uh-huh. And I was like, I'm going to double up on art classes. And I'm going to take, both performing arts and visual arts every year. So, that's what I did.
Wow.
But at the end of high school, I would say, back when cable television was still a thing, and this is pre-Aliens History Channel.
Right.
They had a lot of good documentaries back then, including science documentaries. I remember one in particular, it was called The Universe, and I remember watching that in high school, just being mesmerized by space, and I was like, this sounds like a cool thing to maybe study, and at that point, I was like, I should, start figuring out what I want to actually major in college, and things like that. So it kind of came at a spur of a moment, kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So then, it was the timing where you were just about to, figure out how you were going to specialize and stuff. So
exactly, it was like in your senior year, like after I got accepted into college, you had to make a decision. They asked you like, what major are you going to declare going in? And you had to declare something. I was like, astronomy sounds cool. I'm going to declare astronomy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you majored in astronomy in college.
Well, so I technically majored in physics, was a concentration. Okay. Astronomy.
Okay, sure.
Basically astronomy.
And where was that?
I did my undergrad at Cornell.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did they not have an astronomy major, or is it just?
Yeah, they actually did have an astronomy major, and I came in declaring an astronomy major. But the physics major and astronomy major were so similar. They were there was like I think one course that was different between them.
Yeah.
And at that point, I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So the physics major was just a bit more flexible because you can concentrate in astronomy, but you can concentrate in a bunch of different things.
Right.
So I was like, instead of committing to just doing astronomy, I declare physics, and then I can always concentrate in astronomy, which is my intention, or if I didn't want to, I could switch and pivot to something else.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Especially since you were just now deciding you wanted to do science.
Exactly.
That's interesting. Yeah. Were your parents, is it all influences on science, on your interest in science, or?
I mean, I'm sure my parents had to have some sort of influence in science. My dad did his PhD in chemistry. But there must be some inherent, I never really engaged with his research. I didn't really know what he did.
Yeah.
Only in college did I actually understand what he was doing in his PhD research. Because shortly after his PhD, he then transitioned to working in software because that's where all the jobs were. So when I moved back to the U.S., like shortly after, just a couple years, he transitioned to industry. And then I really wasn't in a science environment growing up.
I see. Interesting.
Because my parents were effectively engineers, engineering like rubbed off more on me than science, I would say, growing up.
So the idea of like, that's what you would do with a mathy background as you'd be an engineer.
Yeah, I'd be like engineer. I was like, civil engineering, we'll build bridges. I remember doing those little things as a kid where you like take those popsicle sticks and build bridges.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't say I was really good at them, but
as a kid, you get the sense that there's a way you're supposed to do it, but nobody knows what it is.
It's
something to do with triangles.
Yeah, something like that. I'm sure like if my parents would look at it and be like, there's definitely an obvious solution, but I was just like, I have no idea.
That's good.
Yeah.
Why do you think astrophysics, what makes you interested in astrophysics and not other types of physics?
I mean, I think, you know, astrophysics at that time when I started, when I was graduating college or was in college, it was really taking off in lots of different exciting ways. And in particular for me, I was really excited by the all the discoveries of extrasolar planets. It was, you know, around, you know, 2010, 2012. This is when Kepler was really finding a bunch of new planets and things like that. So then I think, you know, that entire field was really buzzing, and that was really exciting. And I also think that, you know, my research experiences in undergrad doing astronomy were really exciting and really impactful, and that really made me want to pursue it. Even though I did have other options, I did do a summer summer research in particle physics one summer.
Oh, yeah.
And then I also did a summer internship as a software engineer.
Software engineer.
Yeah. So I actually, in my senior year, I actually had to decide between taking job offers at software companies or applying to grad school to go to to do a study astronomy.
Right. Have this big bag of money.
Yeah.
Or
it really was. It was either you have this big bag of money and just take it now, or decline all that money and then apply to see if you got into graduate school.
If you get into graduate school and maybe get to have something interesting happen.
Exactly. But and you know, a lot of people, when I made that decision to turn down those job offers, everyone thought, you know, this is the worst decision you've ever made. You know, why would you do such a thing? You know, looking back at it, the opportunity cost, you know, of declining those job offers, probably somewhere in about $1 million or so, probably.
Right.
But like, you know, I wanted to try something, you know, especially when you're young, try something that's exciting. You know, it may not you know, succeed, but you know, at least you give it a shot.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Then that was my mentality going in, and I think my astronomy advisor in undergrad really convinced me. Who was, I mean, maybe he was, you know, pushing me towards one side.
Yes,
but you know,
yes.
the kind of the argument that really kind of hooked me was, you know, it was like, you know, even if you just do the PhD for the sake of the PhD, he thought like his PhD experience was worthwhile just for the sake of the PhD. So like, not even. Even if you didn't continue after doing becoming a professor and things like that, just having that experience you thought was worthwhile. So I was like, you know, I'll do this and try the same thing, you know, try a PhD, you know, if I don't like it, I know I have the skills to transition, but if I do like it, you know, I can keep doing it.
Yeah.
And here I am.
It soon seems that you did like it.
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate to do some pretty exciting, and fun things. I think, you know, the theme of all my research, especially even starting in undergrad, was like new instrumentation, new technology.
Uh-huh.
So I was actually working on one of the first light instrument for the SOFIA telescope, which is a NASA observatory on a 747 airplane. So they took a old 747, carved a giant hole in the back, put a 2-meter telescope in there, and they fly it around observing things from you know, like not on the ground but not all the way up to outer space, you know, somewhere in between in the stratosphere.
It's kind of an incredible, like, you know, if you haven't seen images of the SOFIA, it's kind of a weird, incredible thing to like see photos of. You can Google.
Yeah.
It's just like there's a giant telescope sticking out of a plane.
You know, it's, you know, it's like, you know, who thought, like, you know, we could carve a giant hole in the, like, the fuselage of a plane and it would still fly.
It would still fly.
And we should
also
do this.
Also, this telescope would be, like, functional.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, like, it doesn't just completely
It's actually pretty cool. Yeah. Like, when you're on the observatory, because there's turbulence, right? You can actually see the telescope wobble, but the telescope is actually on gyroscope. So the telescope is actually staying still. The entire airplane
the
is actually
wobbling.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's like, that's crazy.
Yeah. It's pretty fun. I was actually on some of the first light flights for SOFIA, because we were, like, my the professor I was working with, he was building the first instrument for commissioning of Sophia. So I actually ended up in the Sophia safety training video.
So you were on the plane?
I was on the plane.
Cool.
On the plane before they like fully commissioned the plane, so they had not everything was like fully set up yet. And one of the things was the safety training video hadn't been done yet. So when I was on the plane, there was like these camera crew on the plane, like doing various shooting various things, and I just somehow got caught up in some like B-roll footage they were filming. And the funny thing is, you know, I never knew that. They just like, they did that. And then right before I graduated, I managed to get on another Sophia flight to help them observe for more science things.
So I had
to go do the safety training video. And then everything was like, oh yeah, this is fine. I heard this last time, except, you know, this time is the video. Last time was like some guy just talking to me about it. But then at the very end, it was just a shot of my face. It was a shot of like someone working. It was just like a zoom in on my face and they're slowly zooming out and then goes to black.
How surreal.
Yeah, it was absolutely like, surreal. I'm like, that's me. I still need to take this video? Like, I'm in the video.
That's right. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, so I mean, I had like a great experience in my undergrad research, you know.
Yes.
Like doing, like working on a new instrument, you know, really feeling the thrill of discovery, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That really made me want to pursue this kind of profession.
Okay. So I have a question I usually ask, and I don't know, maybe you've already answered it, but when do you feel that you learned how to be a scientist?
Oh, that's a good question. When did I feel I would say probably sometime in graduate school, probably near the end.
Mm-hmm.
I know in undergrad, I was probably just like doing whatever my advisor told me to do.
Right.
But I think, you know, being a scientist really involves knowing how to ask the right questions and asking questions that are both testable and interesting. So you want to ask a question that not only is interesting, but like there's a way that with current methodology we can actually test it in some way.
Yes.
And I think you don't really experience that until you go through a couple of research projects and start understanding like this is something that's actually doable and this is like this is not doable or this is trivially doable and you know, trying to actually figure
something
out what that
right
is.
In the middle.
Right in the middle. And I think, you know, near the end of graduate school, you know, I think that's kind of what graduate school is all about. It's like the training to be a scientist.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're learning how to do it. And and if you have a good advisor, you learn how to be a scientist.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's not part of the curriculum, but like somehow you learn it. It's like trial by fire or apprenticeship.
We don't have a class on here's how to be a scientist. I mean, we have like some things.
Yeah.
But, like,
I feel like it's kind of the apprenticeship nature of graduate school, right? As you do it, it kind of all comes together to you. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's the idea anyway.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I feel like it's one of those things that you try to like explain, and you can explain it in like 5 minutes, but then it doesn't really, like, you don't really appreciate it until you actually try to apply it.
That's right. You can say what it is to be a scientist, and somebody go like, oh yeah, I get that. And
you're
like, no, you don't.
No. You can explain it in 5 minutes, but it takes 5 years to actually appreciate it.
To really get what that means. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So now you're an astrophysicist.
Yes.
Okay. So what are some things you like the most about your job?
I mean, I still really enjoy just the thrill of discovery. Every time, you know, we find something new or unexpected, just novel about the universe, that's always exciting and fun. And it's charting new horizons. I think that just intrinsically is great.
Mm-hmm.
I really like, you know, talking to people, non-astronomers, about my work, because you can really, you can talk about all the exciting things and like really remind you about like why you're doing what you're doing.
That's right.
And now that I'm a professor, I'm running my own research group. I think it's very satisfying to kind of manage a research group and watch people develop and, you know, accomplish things that, you know, you've helped grow and things like that. I think that's also a really fulfilling aspect of my job.
I love that too.
Yes.
Good. Is there anything you don't like about your job?
I would say probably the hardest part of my job as a assistant professor at a research university is I'm a I'm effectively doing at least two full-time jobs, and for one full-time job, you're both teaching classes. You're also running a research group, and like each of those things in itself could be a full-time
job. That's right. Each of those is a full-time job.
They're both part of your job, so you have to figure out how to condense two full-time jobs potentially into one full-time job. Yeah. And that's always a tricky business, I would say.
Yeah. How do you do that? are you successful at it, or do you end up just staying here really long hours?
I try not to stay here for really long hours. My PhD advisor has some good sayings, and one of the ones he really likes is "perfect is the enemy of good."
Yes.
I aim to be good enough in all of my various duties, but not try to aim for perfection, because I feel like that last little bit to aim for perfection takes a lot of time.
That will double your workload.
And, yeah, for sure. And in something like teaching classes, you kind of have to come to the understanding that the first time you teach it is not going to be the best time you teach it.
Sorry guys, this isn't going to be as good as it will be for future
folks. And and I think once I became okay with that teaching, I think it's a lot easier when you know that you're not aiming for perfection the first time.
Right.
I don't know if my students know that. I haven't told them this to them. So, but
well, don't let them listen to the podcast.
They shouldn't listen to the podcast. But if they're listening, I totally didn't mean it. None of that was true. But if they're not listening, then yes, this is
absolutely true.
Absolutely true.
So yeah, I mean that's definitely. I mean, I find that it's inevitably the case that you're not going to be as good the first time.
Yeah,
and it's just how it is.
Yeah, and especially in a situation where you have a bunch of different responsibilities.
And it's not really your fault either. It's kind of like we're not hired as teachers.
Yeah, well,
we're not hired for our teaching abilities, and we aren't given any sort of training to teach
that. It's kind of surprising there's no training at all for a new professor for teaching. They just tell you that you have academic freedom to teach however you like.
Yes.
And then they tell you about the rules that you must follow for teaching.
Yes.
But not how to teach. It's just these are rules, various procedural rules that you must follow.
Right.
And then they tell you to go have fun.
Yeah.
I was fortunate in graduate school to have taken a pedagogy course. I feel that's the only time where I really had the opportunity to sit down and think about teaching philosophy and how to teach and teaching strategies and how to do this practically and implement it in a course.
Yeah.
Beyond that, they just you just start and see how it goes.
Good luck. You have the freedom.
Yeah.
All right. So, what would you say is the most was the most challenging part of getting to where you are now in academia?
The most challenging part is probably I'd say probably just the job searching process.
Yeah.
I think especially going from being a postdoc after your PhD, you're often in a research position for a few years, mm-hmm. and then actually trying to find a permanent faculty job. Yes. I think that is...
You're basically your whole time you're applying for your next job.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of...
that's probably what politicians feel like, right?
I kind of get a sense for how the House might feel. Yeah. But it really is some of this kind of same vibes. You're on 2 to 3 year short-term contracts, and every year you're thinking about what's the end is near.
Yes.
And you're always thinking about what's the next thing, and how can I how can I advertise myself to to get to that next step. And some people say postdocs are the best time because you can really focus on research, but for me, I was really just focusing on what am I going to do next.
Yes.
And I would say it's very distracting from research in many ways.
I definitely like this stage better than the postdoc stage.
I would agree. Even though you're trying to balance many more responsibilities, I feel like it's much more secure.
Right. Yeah. You're not just desperately trying to stay afloat.
Yeah. Yeah. So for anyone trying to going through this now, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Yes.
when you meet a new grad student or a fellow scientist and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
I usually tell them I work on imaging exoplanets, so there are planets orbiting other stars, and actually trying to take pictures of them next to their these really faint planets right next to the glare of their really bright stars.
Okay, so now, so we're talking about exoplanets, which are a really popular topic, and actually you're my first exoplanet person to come on the podcast, and it's a very popular topic because we're thinking about planets orbiting other stars. It's very cool, but your thing is actually most people I know of that do exoplanets I think your stuff is really cool because you are actually, like you said, you're actually imaging them.
That's right.
So you actually take a picture of the solar system, this distant solar system. You can actually see the planets in the in the image.
Yeah, we try to do the hard thing. Everyone else is trying to do the easy shortcuts, but we do the hard thing.
You do the actual. You want to get an actual photo of that planet. Yes. So
We spend a lot of time toiling just to get that photo.
Right, so what do you have to do to get the kind of describe, I know you quickly said it, but you should kind of describe what are the challenges involved.
The main challenge is that you're trying to see something extremely faint next to something really bright, so it's like anytime if you're like walking at night and there's like a really bright street light ahead and you're trying to read like some sign right behind that street light or something, like being able to actually read that sign is much harder. And this is a much more amplified version of that.
Way more amplified version because the star, of course, the star is just way brighter than a planet would be.
The brightest stars we're talking about, the brightest planets we're talking about are about 100,000 or a million times fainter than their stars. Right. So
that's a very extreme version of the street lamp.
Yes, very extreme version of the street lamp. I actually like to give the analogy. It's like trying to see a firefly either orbit like a really bright street lamp or a lighthouse.
Looking at a lighthouse. Oh, I think I see a firefly.
Yeah, you see a firefly just like orbiting right around it, circling right around that lighthouse. Yeah, that's what we kind of try to do.
So that's what you're trying to design, technologies that can see something like that.
That's right. So we combine both kind of optical technologies as well as data processing algorithms to be able to separate the signal of the faint planet from the glare of the star.
Okay, and these data processing techniques, that goes back to your background in coding and
it does. One of my first projects was actually to implement a bunch of data processing techniques from various folks and make it into an open source and optimized package for the community to use. And that's been my bread and butter for many years, was to kind of have this package and apply it to a bunch of different things and have other people also use it, because the nice thing about open source tools is once it's out there, anyone can pick it up and apply it to their own research, and it just makes these especially extremely technical fields a lot more accessible.
Yes.
So that someone else starting for the first time doesn't have to redo everything that you just had to toil away and do.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Open source, the whole concept of open source is technology or open source codes and stuff has the past decade or so has become like that, we've shifted towards open source in astrophysics.
Right.
And it's interesting because we should have shifted so much longer, so much earlier than that, because we're in academics. That's the whole point of academics is we're open source.
Right.
We're all trying to learn about the same things. Yeah. We should be like sharing.
Yeah, open science, reproducibility. These are all important things.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Yeah. It has been this weird. It's only kind of recent that there's shift has been made, and the nowadays the really popular tools are all the open source tools because they're the most popular languages are the ones that are spoken.
Yeah.
And if you keep your language a secret, then no one will speak it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a game theory kind of thing going on, especially in the past when there wasn't really any incentive to put your code out there.
Yes.
By having this exclusive access to this code, people would have to come to you, and like, you're like the one
the gatekeeper.
You're the gatekeeper. You're the important person in the field because you have access to this unique tool.
If you want this model, I can make you one.
Yeah.
For a price.
you can think of it like the first person that open sources their tool is at a disadvantage because everyone can use their tool, right. but also has their own tools that that's person right. can't use.
That's right.
So you have to be willing to make that leap. But once you make that leap and the community starts buying into the tool, then suddenly you're at the advantage.
The people that are that have their proprietary codes are suddenly not looking so good.
They don't need it. Like people don't need them anymore, right. and that value that they brought that they had in the community isn't nearly as important anymore because there are open tools that anyone could pick up and use rather than having to go to them and ask them to run their tool.
Yes, that's interesting. So it's sort of there's sort of some transition where that there's a shift.
Yeah, and I think part of it is just the culture of the community wanting to do that shift.
Yes.
And then now I think large funding organizations like NASA are promoting the and oftentimes requiring things to be open source or open science or open data.
Now a part of grant proposals is your data management plan and where you're going to declare what of yours is you're going to make open, and that will affect whether you get this grant.
Right. And there's obviously details in the implementation that need to be worked out in the right way to make sure it's sustainable, but I'm generally in favor of doing this. I think as you said, science is all about being open and being reproducible, and that's like this whole spirit of it, so why not promote these kind of behaviors?
So let's get back to what this code is, what these tools are doing. Yeah, in the abstract, they're open source. We got that. But what is it? What? So the idea is to try to pick out this planet
you're seeing all this glare from the star, right. and you're trying to pick out what is the distinctive signature of a planet in the data. And we use different algorithms to kind of decide. They're all. They can all be classified as machine learning algorithms in some way. They're these data-driven algorithms that say, if we collect all this data on the glare of the star, even if we don't know exactly from first principles how to model it, we can collect all this data on the glare of the star and then be able to use that to model out the portion of our image that is dominated by the glare of the star subtract it off.
I see. So you have to look at the star for a while and get a sense for what its behavior is, and then you say, I can mock up something that behaves like that and try to subtract it off.
Yeah, and it does come with cool buzzwords like blind signal separation, principal component analysis.
That does sound
non-negative
fancy.
Matrix factorization. the words get more and more
non-negative.
Not only positive values are allowed. It does come with these buzzwords and people have different flavors and things like that, but they all kind of behave in the same kind of underlying way.
So that's cool. So then it's interesting. So I always find this kind of because you get into it because you're interested in astrophysics, but a lot of your time is spent deep in these algorithms.
That's right.
And so how do you kind of how do you keep in thinking, keep your eyes on this general concept of planets that you're interested in? And
I think it's definitely a challenge, and I think the balance you need to strike as a researcher is kind of always have a science-driven reason for doing what you're doing in the technical field. So even we're not just implementing this new algorithm for the sake of having a new algorithm. It's we're implementing because we think this will unlock some new science that we're trying to reach. And having always knowing that I think is important. And that's definitely something I didn't think about in the beginning. But I developed the scientist, this is the things that start coming to me now.
So can you give me an example of that, a science result that you get from being able to image these planets?
Yeah, so by imaging the planets and getting multiple images over time, we can actually watch these planets move. And then as we watch these planets move, we can trace out their orbits and understand their dynamical histories, how many interactions, gravitational interactions do these planets have, where do these planets migrate from, things like that.
So you can actually even over time make a movie of the planets going around.
That's right. Not only do we have real images of planets, we have real movies of planets.
Do you have a Google image search keywords that people can type in to find the...
Yes, I would just recommend searching the word exoplanet on Google. Go to Wikipedia, which is probably the first link, and look at the first image on Wikipedia's article on exoplanets.
Okay, and then you'll see. It's one an image you made?
Yeah.
Or, it's a movie.
It's a movie.
That's taken of...
multiple exoplanets. There's four, I believe, if no one has edited the Wikipedia page, right. It should be four exoplanets orbiting a star. It's a time lapse. I think it's probably 7 years is the one on Wikipedia.
Yes. Let's hope that when people listen to this podcast in 50 years, it'll still be up there on Wikipedia.
It'll still be
up Wikipedia will still exist.
The same time lapse. only 7 years.
only be a 7 year time lapse.
Yeah, but it's still
not
the same
bother
one.
Get more.
I mean, it gets the point across, right?
Yes,
why bother?
That's right.
Yeah. So that's kind of oftentimes people ask, have you done anything important, for our field, for society, I'm just like, just go to Wikipedia and look up exoplanet, I made the first image.
That's right.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, even just from looking, just being able to see something like that and just be able, because we don't even really have anything like that for our own solar system.
That's right.
And so being able to just look at and kind of gives you a sense. I pretended like I didn't know about this, but I've shown this to students, undergrad or even high school students that are interested in planets, and mm-hmm. Their eyes widen up when they see it, because they're like, oh, that's what these things are doing.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to teach me in class that they orbit around this.
Exactly. You actually see it in real life,
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's just one of those things like even Galileo would see or immediately recognize what we're looking at.
Right,
kind of
exactly.
Things. Yeah.
That's very cool. So then what kind of, we already talked about kind of the day-to-day tasks that you do, trying to get into this, to solve these algorithms. So I don't know. What do you think is your most, either your most impactful contribution or something you're most proud of, or a recent result you're really proud of? Or
yeah, I would say the most impactful contribution I made to the entirety of exoplanets is making that seven-year time-lapse
movie. Okay.
Yeah, I would say. for the amount of reach it's gotten, of the views that I can track, there's at least 5 million views.
Okay, that's more than this podcast. So I'll tell you that right now.
As of recording, it is more than this podcast.
I don't think I'm beating you anytime soon.
beyond that, I think a lot of the most important things I'm making contribution-wise to our field is things that are extremely technical happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
Really pushing new techniques and technologies so that one day one of them will enable us to image another potentially habitable planet around another star.
Oh, I didn't realize this. You think that it'll be possible? You think that it'll be possible to actually image habitable? Because these ones yes. we can image have to be giant.
Yeah,
right?
So right now all the planets we're imaging are giant Jupiter-like planets we're imaging.
Right, because they got to be really big in order for us to see them.
Yeah, exactly.
So you think it's going to be possible one day to see an Earth-like planet or something? We don't have to say Earth-like, but something habitable.
Yes. I've definitely drank the Kool-Aid of we think that we can in our lifetimes image Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone, the zone in which we think liquid water could exist on the surfaces of terrestrial planets around other stars.
Wow.
But we don't know exactly how to get there.
Right.
This is
new technologies will need to be developed.
New technologies will need to be developed, and what we're doing right now in my research group is kind of pushing these new technologies and seeing, we're trying a bunch, not like we're just doing one, and seeing which of these actually is successful.
So that's the big game right now.
That's the big game. That's the dream. There's a lot of people working on this endeavor. There's lots of different aspects of being able to actually image another habitable world. There's the entire field of trying to even identify planet candidates, like which stars should we be looking around.
Right.
There's an entire field of identifying how do we actually even assess habitability, even if we can see a planet. How do we know it's habitable?
Right.
I only work on the how do we see the planet apart?
Right.
Want to get us there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of I don't know. To me, that's then you get to make the image.
Yeah,
right?
Once you make the image, then all the fun begins. That's what we're hoping to get to.
Wow. Okay. So, all right. Now I'll ask you the hard question.
All right.
In your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics?
Yeah, I actually am teaching a class right now, and my students ask me about this in my class all the time.
I get family members asking me about it.
Yeah.
So that's why I ask everyone I interview this so I can get an answer. But
yeah, I think there's a few things. I think one is just our fundamental desire to kind of explore the unknown, and mm-hmm. Space is really kind of the final frontier of we've at least the surface of this planet we've explored pretty well. Maybe not the depths of the oceans and things like that.
Right.
But we've explored so little of outer space, and just our kind of inherent interests as a species and kind of understanding what's out there. I think mm-hmm. that itself is value for us as a society, just to know what's out there.
Right.
What is the context of this outer space that we're living in?
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is there's an importance in basic research, just doing studying new things that we don't know, and it will we will learn new things, and some of it will potentially revolutionize how we as a society operate. Some of it may not, but we have mm-hmm. to kind of build up that wealth of knowledge to even know what kind of possibilities are out there.
Right. Right. So there's a lot of of course that's a lot of how science and generally human knowledge works, is you kind of investigate whatever you think is interesting, and then a lot of it is serendipitous. You discover things that are beneficial to society that you didn't expect.
Yeah, or even things that you discover and then you later realize are beneficial to society.
Right, right.
Like, Einstein, invented, came up with this theory of general relativity, and mm-hmm. you're like, oh, this is all black holes, how does this relevant to anything on Earth? But now, for any GPS global positioning satellite system to work, they have to account for general relativistic time corrections.
Right.
And without the theory of relativity, none of our GPS satellites would work.
Right.
And then we'd never get around anywhere. We couldn't find our ways. We'd have to use maps still.
Right. Yeah, we would have to use maps peasants.
Yeah.
But so also arguably GPS satellites wouldn't be there without NASA in general, but
rocket science, all literally rocket science.
But, yes. But you're right. The fun example of general relativity is that seems so academic.
Yeah.
And everything we do is academic because we're academics.
We're academics.
But it seems like, well, how could that possibly be useful?
And
it's
just
wait, there'll be something. I can't tell you what. Uh-huh. It'll be useful somehow.
Right. It's stuff that we can't even envision, right? Because we don't even know what's out there. Right now people are not me, but other people are studying things like dark energy, right? And what is this thing that exists all throughout our entire universe, but we never interact with it, but is a source of energy that prevents the universe from collapsing.
Right. I don't know. Who knows? Yeah, if we figure out what that is, who knows what
who
that
knows
will tell us?
That will tell us. Exactly.
What we'll learn from that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's a good way to think about it. So what do you think is what's next on the horizon for you? What are the next big things that you think are interesting to look at? You already said you want to see an Earth.
Yeah, we want to see it. We want to find a habitable planet. How are we going to get there? Maybe we'll get lucky in the next decade. We could get one. Maybe this is going to be a hard endeavor and it'll take us many decades. But that's kind of the long term goal. The near term goal, kind of in the next few years, what I like mm-hmm. to understand is right now we're talking about how we're studying giant planets with direct imaging. Mm-hmm. I really want to understand how typical is our own Jupiter.
How typical is our Jupiter?
Our Jupiter, our most massive planet in our system. We mm-hmm. think Jupiter's pretty useful. It shielded the Earth from a bunch of asteroid impacts and things like that, and maybe helped deliver water to the Earth. Important member, potentially.
Oh, okay. Yeah. These are ideas about how the solar system might have formed.
Uh-huh. And it's the most gravitationally most influential planet in our system.
Right,
It's the big one. And what I want to do in the next few years is actually study, how typical is it?
If you look at a bunch of exoplanet systems, how many of them have something like a Jupiter?
How many have something like a Jupiter? And if they do they have similar compositions to our own Jupiter?
Right.
Or do they look completely different from our own Jupiter?
Yeah.
Did our Jupiter form in a way that's very common or distinctive? And, you know, that could, because it's so influential, that might point us to, you know, how common or distinctive our own solar system is.
Well, Jupiter is my favorite planet.
Yes.
When I was a kid, Saturn was my favorite, but now Jupiter is my favorite.
Jupiter is also my favorite planet now. Although the students in my class, I think their top two are somehow Saturn for sure, and somehow Mercury is, really? Is in second place
Mercury,
right now.
Mercury? Didn't see that coming.
That's just a new generation.
These kids and their Mercury.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, but yeah, I love Jupiter because I'm into fluid dynamics, and you can see what fluids look like in 2D on the surface of Jupiter.
Yeah.
And that's where that's why you get the big red dot.
Yeah, the big red dot's so cool.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of the dot.
Well, I hope it sticks around for a long time.
Yeah. We still don't know how long it's gonna stick around for.
How long is it gonna be around for?
It's such a distinctive feature, yet we have no idea. We have no idea how long it's gonna stick around for.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
So okay, well, I think that was you did a great job.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
So thank you so much, Dr. Wang, for joining us. And I had a lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you'll join us again sometime.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Well, that was everything I hoped it would be. I highly recommend those movies that Jason has made of orbiting planets. I might as well plug his website, jasonwang.space. That's jasonwang.space. You can find out more about Jason's research and find a whole gallery of planet movies he's created from his incredible datasets. So thank you again, Jason, for talking with us about planets, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. All music on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford. You'll find it on her album Trotter. All songs were used with permission from the artist and producer. Look up Britton Ashford if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.